If you've been feeling the job market is weak,
the government just said you're right.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, June 1st.
Coming up, the view from the unemployment line in the Pacific Northwest.
And with hurricane season now underway, companies are pressured to reveal their exposure to extreme weather.
Plus, maybe now's not the time to launch a new stock.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The big jobs report for the month came out today. The government recorded just 69,000 additional names on payrolls in May. That is much weaker than expected and fits into a picture of a U.S. economy that is barely treading water. A separate survey of households puts the unemployment rate for May at 8.2%, a slight increase from April. Joining me is Marketplace's Amy Scott. Amy, reading deeper, what do you see?
Well, David, it gets worse. Listen to these revisions. You know, that disappointing report from last month is actually worse than we thought. The Labor Department says we only added 77,000 jobs in April, not 115,000. And it revised March downward, too. So now we're looking at several months in a row of sluggish job growth. And the number of people part-time who'd rather be working full-time grew to by a few hundred thousand to 8.1 million people.
But back to the headline figure, 69,000 additional jobs added when you just look at the non-farm payrolls. What do you think it's going to take to return the labor market back to something that might look like health?
Right. Well, a lot faster and more consistent job growth. We've been speaking to economists who say we really need to see growth of about 200,000 to 250,000 jobs a month, every month. And that would have to last for the next 7 years to get anything close to where we were before the recession. So this is pretty bad news. We were seeing that kind of growth actually at the beginning of the year. But in the last couple months, it really has slowed down.
Briefly, though, any notes of encouragement at all in this May jobs report?
Well, there was a slight uptick in the labor participation rate, which may reflect more people coming back to look for work, which is part of that slight rise in the unemployment rate to 8.2%. Healthcare, transportation saw some job increases, but really most industries stayed pretty flat.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
With another view on the jobs report today, let's turn to Christopher Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So, Chris, these numbers look pretty bleak. What do you make of them?
Yeah, okay. So on the surface, absolutely, it was an ugly report, and it's worth mentioning again those revisions. With the revisions, the average job growth in the last 3 months was actually less than 100,000 a month. So that's the bad news, the rise in the unemployment rate also. But the good news is that maybe, just maybe, what we're seeing is a seasonal anomaly in the numbers. This is a theory, the way, that's not just me. It's the Bureau of Labor Statistics thinks so, too, where job growth in the winter is overstated. In the spring, it's understated. And the reason is that the economy has changed. We just don't have nearly as much construction activity as we used to have in prior cycles. And so we're seeing a soft patch just like last spring, just like the spring before. The good news is it's a little bit less soft than it was the last 2 years.
Well, Chris, if there is a seasonal element to these numbers, let's take a broader look at the economy. So in general, where do you see things right now?
Well, GDP growth last quarter was 1.9% after revision. And in the last year, it was 2%. And in the year before that, it was 2%. And I think that's sort of where we're stuck. We're growing at about 2%, which is not great compared to prior cycles. It's pretty weak, but it does mean we have the best growth of any major economy in the world right now.
Speaking of the world, we've gotten a lot of bad economic news out of Europe and out of China today. Growth seems to be slowing there more quickly than expected. What does that mean for the U.S.?
Well, there's no question that what we're looking at is a global recession. Now, normally when there's a global recession, it starts in the U.S., it spreads to the rest of the world. The last time it started somewhere else was the recession of 1998, and shockingly, no one expected it, but the U.S. economy actually accelerated because commodity prices fell, including gasoline and food. The cost of labor came down. Consumer goods got cheaper. And we picked up. I think the same thing could very well happen this time. The biggest risk would be the banking system, but our banks are also in the best shape they have been in 5 years.
Chris Lowe, I'm going to have to stop you right there. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
More now from Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, who went out to a state job center in Portland, Oregon, to take the pulse of people who are on the unemployment lines.
People become unemployed every day for all kinds of reasons, some having nothing to do with the recession or business conditions. Take Kara Kay. She's a hospice caregiver.
I worked for a wonderful woman for about 2 years, and she passed away a week ago, so I'm unemployed.
But she's not worried, not yet. Her kids are grown. She gets about $250 a week on unemployment.
And I do have a savings account. There's a phenomenal concept for you.
And what are you looking for?
Now, that's a good question. I'm going to be 55 next month. I've done this for 23 years. I'm very good at what I do, and I'm also very tired of it. It's difficult physically, it's difficult mentally and emotionally, it's exhausting spiritually, and because I'm unemployed, I have the option of being retrained.
Kay's eager to get on with that. The days of federal unemployment benefits stretching out nearly 2 years are over. Her checks from the state will probably run out in 6 months. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There is already news today that unemployment in the countries that use the euro has hit 11%. That's the highest since Europe began tracking this data in 1995.
And the hurricane season begins officially today as weather gets more severe and unpredictable. It's not just the insurance industry that's vulnerable. As Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from the Sustainability Desk, some investor groups are pressuring companies to disclose their exposure to this risk in greater detail.
Stronger and more frequent storms have insurance companies pulling out of parts of the Bahamas and Florida. Seed companies are designing more weatherproof crops, and an oil company is moving pipes out of hurricane harm's way. They're all hedging against climate risk, and investors want more companies to disclose more about their risk. Maryland State Treasurer Nancy Kopp chairs the state's $36 billion state pension system.
As investors, the large funds budget not only money, we try to budget risk. We try to know what areas are more risky than others. We have to know that the companies in which we invest recognize the risks which they face.
The new report from Calvert Investments and Oxfam suggests how companies can disclose climate risk in a way that investors can compare. Some of that's already happening. The federal government requires disclosure, and firms can volunteer info. But different firms report different things, so it's a muddled tower of babbling data for investors. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The weather may not be right for selling stock to go public for the first time. The travel site Kayak is delaying its initial public offering, and now word that Formula One car racing is also pulling the plug for now. From London, Christopher Worth reports.
To understand the recent hesitation to begin trading publicly, Angus Campbell of London Capital Group Holdings says you need to know a bit of British terminology, damp squib.
A damp squib is basically something that has completely fallen through. It would be disappointing. It would be very, very annoying.
What would an IPO look like if it were a damp squib?
Well, it would look like Facebook.
Campbell says Facebook's belly flop last week has scared off companies and investors alike. But Rupert Nathan at the stock brokerage Fat Profits says the main driver is global worries about the Eurozone crisis and a slowdown in China and elsewhere.
The thinking could be that, you know, let's wait for the storm to pass and we can then come back and hopefully, you know, get a better price than we might have previously done.
Which may be a good call. All told, the amount raised from IPOs has slumped by 46% since last year. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Plus, listen to what the head of the bank that underwrote Facebook's ill-fated IPO is saying. Morgan Stanley CEO James Gorman told CNBC that investors who bought Facebook looking for immediate gains were, quote, naive. They bought it under what he called the wrong pretenses.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Next week, California voters head to the polls for a primary election. We think of California as a single state, of course, but if you probe the data and look at things like income, education, life expectancy, a more complex picture emerges. Demographer Sarah Bird Sharps, co-director of Measure of America, sees five separate Californias, each with its own separate social and economic reality. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, David.
What do you mean five Californians? It looks like one state to me on the map.
Yep. So we looked at how people were doing all along a spectrum in terms of well-being, and we found that it really broke down into five distinct profiles, which we called the five Californias.
Like 18% are metro, coastal, enclave California. That's the people who live near L.A., near San Francisco. We have struggling California. That's 38% of the population. What else do you have?
Well, at the very top, we have Silicon Valley, Shangri-La, and Shangri-La's in a couple of areas in Santa Clara. And then at the very bottom, we have the forsaken 5%, which is populations around inner city L.A., but also the San Joaquin Valley.
But the biggest population, you call the Main Street California. There's a major public policy implication.
Absolutely. One of the things that we found that really surprised us is that of the 2,500 high schools in California, about 100 high schools account for under half the dropouts. So if you want to deal with the dropout problem, you have to focus laser-like on those high schools. In terms of health, the thing that was really surprising to us is that the major gains aren't really so much from doctors and medicines, but they're really from the conditions we grow up in. So providing communities with walkability, reducing, you know, toxicity in neighborhoods, et cetera, is really critical.
Now, speaking again of the fancy pants part of California, Silicon Valley, what you call Shangri-La, I assume there are no public policy recommendations. Everything is perfect at that level.
Well, they definitely have all the tools they need in their toolbox to seize opportunities and to live to their full potential. Though one thing that we did find is a tremendous gender wage gap. So among high-wage professional women, these women are earning 49 cents to every dollar that men are earning.
49 cents for every buck.
That's right.
Sarah Bird Sharps is co-director of Measure of America. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Today, Walmart celebrates its 50th anniversary. At the same time, shareholders are gathering at Walmart headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, for the company's annual meeting. Walmart's board of directors is likely to take some heat for high executive pay, as well as a Mexican bribery scandal. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Walmart employees gathered at a Shakey's pizza parlor near Los Angeles last week. Venanzi Luna asked her co-workers to vote for a proposal that would change the way CEO Mike Duke gets paid.
We need to show Mike Duke who's boss. And it's not fair that he makes $3,000 an hour and we get paid minimum wage.
She's one of the employee shareholders behind a proposal to curb executive pay. Luna and her colleague Carlton Smith came here to get out the vote.
Proposition number 6 is cut and dry. You guys need to take a look at the way these executives are receiving their bonuses.
Smith owns 4 shares of Walmart. Not a lot, but enough for him to attend today's meeting and press his case. John C. Liu, on the other hand, oversees 5.5 million shares of Walmart. Liu is New York City's comptroller and trustee for the city's pension funds. He wants to shake up Walmart's board of directors.
We will vote no against the re-election of 5 of these directors.
Walmart is under investigation for an alleged Mexican bribery scheme and cover-up. Comptroller Liu says his office asked Walmart to step up corporate oversight years ago.
When there are clear indications that the highest levels of Walmart management had been involved in quashing internal investigations, that becomes a threat with regard to the value of our shares.
Walmart declined to comment for this story, but analysts point out that the company's finances are healthy and its stock price is near a 10-year high. And even though several institutional investors plan to vote against Walmart's board today, the executives are unlikely to lose their jobs. Comptroller Liu explains.
There are no delusions that we'll have a majority vote. It's essentially mathematically impossible.
That's because the Walton family controls almost half of the company's shares. So the vote against board members is mostly symbolic. But even if no action is taken, Walmart will get the message. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Student loan debt made headlines back in March when the nation's total student debt load passed $1 trillion. And a new report from the New York Federal Reserve Bank shows that student debt is up nearly 8% in just the last year.
Those are the numbers. Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra about the stories behind the numbers is David Welliver, publisher of the financial advice blog Money Under 30. David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, David.
So you've been writing about financial issues facing students and grads for a number of years now. How did you get started in this area?
Well, I have. And actually, my first job when I graduated from college in 2003 was as an editorial assistant at Smart Money magazine. And despite the fact that I was working and helping with articles on being smart with money, I was actually making a lot of mistakes with my own money and piled on top of my own student loan debt, a bunch of credit card debt, trying to live in New York City on an entry-level salary and not really getting the fact that I had to spend less than I earned. So that's how I got started writing about money. And then I left New York to find higher-paying work and lower rent and also to get my own money in check. So I moved back home with mom and dad and got a job in another industry. But I wanted to keep writing. And that's when I started MoneyUnder30.com to kind of allow myself to write about the experiences I was having, you know, learning to be responsible with my own money and also continue what I had learned as Smart Money.
So what are some of the things that you've learned since starting the blog? Because it sounds like when you started out, you had debt like we all do and weren't necessarily an expert in the area.
Exactly. I didn't know, you know, my left hand from right when it came to managing my money. So it's been a lot of learning since. And, you know, now I shun debt, and I've also, you know, probably put a bigger focus on saving for retirement than I ever would have before I got into writing about finances, something that, you know, is just for most 20-somethings not even on their radar, and especially as we're talking about today with student loans, you know, getting larger and larger when people graduate, you know, things like saving for retirement, buying a home, even getting married and starting a family are going to be pushed off later and later.
I once spent time on a reporting project with a wonderful woman in Baltimore. She had a lot of student loan debt, and she was juggling the calls from the people trying to dun her for the money, and she got driven out of the home that she had because she didn't pay her rent and preferred her student loan. Obviously, that was a mistake. Tell me about some of the mistakes you've run into.
You know, I think personally, one thing I focused on, you know, early on was focusing too much on my credit score and maintaining good credit by, you know, paying everything on time, even when it meant going hungry or, you know, using a credit card again when I should have had, you know. I think had I allowed myself to fall behind a little bit and kind of hit a wall early on with my debt, I would have gotten out faster than by continuing to play the game a little bit. I think, you know, when people cry uncle and they ask for help, like they, you know, hang their tail between their legs and go home and ask mom and dad if they can move back in or if they can get some help with their student loans, that's, you know, you need to, you know, tackle this problem as soon as you can rather than wait like I did.
And tell me, when you hit the wall yourself, what did you do? Because it sounds like that's the moment where you realized, I got to take action. So in your case, what was the action?
I got a second job at Starbucks. So I was working, you know, full-time 40 hours a week in a publishing company. And I went at 5 o'clock. I drove half hour across town to a Starbucks and worked there until 9:30 or 10 at night and basically earned extra money because at the time I was, you know, between making my minimum debt payments and paying for food and my car and gas and things like that, what I was earning in my daytime job was just barely covering that. So in order to make any further progress on my debt, I had to earn more.
David Welliver is the publisher of financial advice blog Money Under 30. David, thank you.
Thank you very much, Stacey.
So, David, did you love middle school as much as I did?
Oh, yeah. the greatest years of my life.
I felt like the peak of that experience were the dances.
Don't you think the dances were the greatest?
Yeah, not awkward in the least.
No, I didn't spend them all in the ladies' room. But as if they weren't bad enough as it is and emotionally scarring enough, the New West Charter School in West Los Angeles created a VIP room for its dances. Now, the VIP room comes complete with a laminated pass, a dessert bar, and a gift bag to take home. A pass costs $5.
That's nice, making it official who the special people are.
I know, it's free for cheerleaders.
All right, now check this out. And finally, in Elyria, Ohio, over near Oberlin College, a possible case of guerrilla marketing through breaking and entering. A woman is accused of breaking into a house, cleaning the place up, and then leaving a bill for $75 scrawled on a napkin. Police say, A, the perpetrator owns a cleaning company, B, that she took nothing, and C, that she claims to have done it before.
I hope she comes to my house. That would be fantastic.
As long as you're digging. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. On APM, American Public Media.